From Sounds True, Dr. Quantum presents A User's Guide to Your Universe, Session 7, where psyche and physics meet with Fred Allen Wolf.
Well, as you see, my adventures in this world, this weird world of quantum physics, has taken me in directions you might not expect. We've looked at, in the previous session, sex, magic, and the shamanic world. The next session is going to take us into where the psyche and physics meet. And you may not guess where that takes place. But where it takes place is in your own dreams. So we're going to be looking at what's called the dreaming universe. Now, first of all, I'm going to give you the bottom line. Why do we dream? That's a natural question, and it doesn't have a definite scientific answer as of yet. So I'm going to give you my speculation here and tell you that we dream to create a self. Huh? I got a self. I know what my self is. I know who I am. I know what I am. What I'm telling you is you don't. You don't really know who you are or what you are or that you have an I or any of that kind of stuff until you start to dream it into existence. And that dreaming is the first stage of becoming aware as in the sense of self-aware. Well, my friends Wim Coleman and Pat Perrin wrote a wonderful book a while back called The Jamais Vu Papers. And in their description, they told a story which kind of resonated with me. And it goes something like this. Imagine, if you will, a realm in which there is no height, width, depth, or time. Imagine an entity who lives in this realm. An entity which we'll call Lixgrib. Imagine that poor Lixgrib is trapped by some sort of extra-dimensional cave-in. There's no escape. But Lixgrib cannot die. His consciousness will continue, all alone and completely paralyzed for eternity. Or whatever the equivalent of eternity is in this rather strange realm of existence. How would you, if you were Lixgrib, deal with this situation? Well, you'd create worlds in your mind. Worlds within yourself. Lixgrib created a whole universe. Now, you might look at that as a kind of a mythology or a story, which may be maybe not exactly the way God would do it, but maybe reminiscent of what God does, if we think of God as somebody that does things, and that God dreams the world into existence. Now, this may seem a far cry from your normal everyday Western look of experiences, but it turns out to be not so far-fetched after all. In fact, many cultures think of the world as the dream of God or dream of spirit. So, we in the West have always been fascinated with dreams, and we have been wondering why we dream, where they come from, but yet we know that they have a kind of a strange power. For example, we know that some people, through their dreams, have the power of divination. They can look into the future. We also know that dreams are used for reawakening memories of events that have passed long time ago. Maybe even have passed in other lives that we may have lived or imagined that we have lived. Many cultures believe that during a dream, what happens to you is that you leave your body and you journey to other worlds, possibly even other universes. The world that we inhabit in our dream is sometimes given a name. It's called the imaginal realm. It's not just the realm of your imagination, which you can touch on during your normal waking consciousness, although it may very well be the same, but it's something else, something in which you have an experience as if you were actually present in this realm called the imaginal realm. When you're in this realm, your dream takes you out of your normal limitations of space and time. Indeed, in the Bible, we are reminded of the prophetic dreams of Joseph. And of course, there are dreams which are said to give creative powers to whoever dreams them. There are the dreams, for example, of the poet-philosopher William Blake, who demonstrated that dreams have prophetic and creative powers. Now, the Australian Aboriginal people are very fascinated with dreams, and they believe that the universe came into existence a very long time ago, arising from an unknowable realm that has been given different names. It was given the name Dreamtime by two English anthropologists around the turn of the 20th century. They called it El Chiringa, but we call it Dreamtime. And as this legend has it, time and space also appeared in the dream. All things, all material objects, all living creatures and plants are nothing but images of this dream. And this great spirit infused the dream with life and enabled all the images in the dream to share in the dream. In other words, the great spirit dreamt you into existence and dreamt you in such a way that you can also dream, so that you are a dream within a dream. And your dreams are dreams within dreams within dreams. And on it goes, levels and levels and levels of dreams. In brief, we are nothing but dreams capable of dreaming. We are the dreamer and the dream at the same time. So are dreams really more than they seem? Perhaps pointing to a deeper meaning of life and a more profound insight into the nature of the whole universe? If so, what could that insight be? Well, I've already told you that. We dream to create a self. Perhaps the Aboriginal legend points to that deeper significance. Is life nothing but a dream? It certainly seems to be a lot more than that to me and to you. What about the everyday world of matter and energy that we see whirling all about us, that we all experience? Is that also nothing but a dream? It may seem like a vast distance, light years to travel, to go from these meandering questions and legends to the present time and our Western way of thinking and observing the universe we see around us, and in particular, to a study of like consciousness and modern dream science. Yet it is precisely this that we are doing, that we will do in this session. We're going to look at the notion that this great spirit is indeed dreaming everything into existence. And just as you dream to make a self, which I have yet to show you how and explain to you, God dreams the universe to have a reflection of himself, herself, itself. And that's what the universe is all about. It's the reflection of the power of the great God or the great spirit. Just as you are the power of the soul dreaming you into existence as a self. And that's what dreams are all about. And that's what I'm going to be telling you. Okay, what do we mean by dreaming? Do I mean the ordinary stuff we do when we go to bed at night and go into the land of Nod? Or do I mean daydreaming or something like that? Does everything dream? Am I saying that matter dreams? Well, let me take a very materialist point of view here. You're made of matter. And according to the materialist point of view, that matter banging into and producing electrical sparks of energy, which travel between neurons and neurons, interneuronally through chemicals and whatever, is just really dead meat pounding into dead meat. and dead meat is nothing but material. And since you dream, that means that dead meat dreams. And if dead meat dreams, that means matter dreams. In other words, matter dreams. Now, to me, the notion that matter dreams is as much do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do as anything else I've said today. In other words, it is just as bizarre to imagine matter dreaming as it is to imagine a great spirit dreaming all this into existence. So we want to look at just what is meant by all of that. First, let's look at the mechanics of dreaming a little bit. What about time and dreams? Let's look at the time of dreams. Is the time that a dream lasts correspond to the actual time you would have experienced if you had been doing the things that you do when you're dreaming? That's a natural question. Some physiologists who've studied this say yes, they are. But I'm not so sure. Let me tell you about the dream of a French neurophysiologist. This guy lived between 1817 and 1892, and his name was Alfred Moret. Now, Moret was a pioneer in the early to mid-19th century study of dreams and sleep. He was perhaps the first to attempt to analyze dreams by observing himself while dreaming, or afterwards. In particular, the effect of external stimulation on dreams. That really occupied a lot of his time. He was particularly interested in the complex procedure by which visual images begin to occur just as one is falling to sleep. We call these today hypnagogic hallucinations. In other words, we think of them as fantasies in some way or another. Well, one evening in 1861, this is a long time ago, Moret had a dream that started people thinking about the relation of external time to his dream time. Moret's dream took him back to around 1793, the time of the French Revolution, and the Reign of Terror that took place in Paris. He reported watching a number of murders. Brought to a trial by a tribunal, he was condemned to the guillotine. Then he was put into a cart along with other criminals and pulled through the streets of Paris, past mobs of jeering people, forced to jostle up and down on the cobblestone streets. He remembers all of that. Arriving at the scaffold, he was forced to mount the stairs leading to the deadly lady. That's what she was called in those days. His hands were bound behind his back, and he was laid on his stomach with his head through the stiles and on the block with the dreaded blade some tens of feet above his head. Suddenly, he felt the blade of the guillotine separate his head from his body. Whoa! Woo-wee, wow-wow, what a dream! That's not easily forgotten, and Moret awoke from it with a start. He was, to say the least, feeling quite anxious. Then he discovered something quite astonishing. The top of his bed had come loose and fallen, striking him in the neck in just the place that a well-aimed guillotine blade would need to strike to separate that head from that body. Think about that. What are we to make of that dream? And his report of the dream. Did the dream take place? The cobblestone streets, watching the murders, going to trial, riding in the cart, getting mounted on the scaffold to get to the guillotine. Did all that take place in the few, maybe 50 to 100 milliseconds? That's thousands of a second. That's less than maybe a tenth of a second, or even let's give it a half a second. Did that all take place during that time when that top of that bed had fallen and hit him on the back of the neck? Was that possible? Perhaps the bed top was loose, and he noticed this just as he went to sleep, and maybe that stimulated the dream. Maybe this had disturbed him, and he had thought that it might fall on him. This might have provoked the dream so that he had a normal dream that coincidentally, that magical word, coincident, coincidentally ended just as a loose part fell. If so, it was a remarkable coincidence. Is that the case? Could it have been that way? Well, Sigmund Freud, who was a pretty rational kind of guy and very much based all of Freudian psychology at the time on the mechanical universal view that Sir Isaac Newton and others before him had provided, when he heard that story, he said that this dream was really the report of a fantasy that Moray had thought about well before the dream and the occasion of the falling bed atop of his head. And that when the falling top of the bed hit him in the head, he recalled that fantasy. In other words, Moray made it all up. He was lying, folks. And he believed that he wasn't lying, and he believed that it was all true, and it was just a fantasy. Well, that could be. I mean, it's always the case that any bizarre story you hear could be a lie and made up. And of course, many skeptical people believe that anything that sounds to be too good to be true is probably too good to be true and should be dismissed as just fantasy. And the only thing real is that which we can prove and approve by experimental facts laid down by objective science. Well, as you might guess, I'm not quite in that camp, although I am very much a scientist, and I believe that you have to be a little skeptical at times. And, you know, if it can be done again, if you can experimentally demonstrate something, then you should. But when it comes to dreams, we're talking about things that pass like ships in the night. You can't quite get them back. So what should we do about that? Ambrose Bierce, in the story of an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, told of a condemned spy in the American Civil War who was about to be hanged from a rope tied to the middle of a bridge over Owl Creek. As his body is dropping, causing the rope to grow taut, the rope breaks and he falls into the creek. Dragged along by the rushing waters, many hundreds of feet, he escapes his tormentors. He climbs ashore and begins a long adventure where he meets people, eats meals, sleeps in somebody's house, journeys back to his home, and so on. But near the end of his story, he finds that something is wrong in the events that he experiences, and they begin to take on an eerie Twilight Zone quality. Suddenly the rope tightens, choking off his air and killing him. It was all a dream, a dying man's last look at the light of the earth, all taking place in his mind in the few thousands of a second it took his body to reach the end of the rope. Well, what this is illustrating, Bierce's story and Moray's story and many other stories that I'm sure you may have heard, is that dream time, the time we spent in dreams, is not exactly the same as the time we spend in waking life. But it may also be, according to some neurophysiologists, indicating something else. Let me tell you about what they say. What they say is that the dream time is pretty much the same as the ordinary time. If that's the case, then the time that Moray saw in his little glimpses of events while he was dreaming had to have been taking place leading up to the exact moment when the guillotine strikes his neck, is when the top of the bed hits him in the back of the neck. That means it would be all coincidence. Or it could also mean that we have the cart before the horse in a time-reverse sense. In other words, what it could mean is that the cause takes place in the future, producing the effect which is the start of the dream in the past. And that cause and effect are time-reversed in this dream world. Now that may seem like a far-fetched idea, but it's not so far-fetched when you start bringing quantum physics into the fold. And it's not so far-fetched when we begin to think that maybe dreams have a more significant role than just hallucinations or fantasies. In the 90s, it became very popular for scientists to begin to investigate what is called the C word. Previous to that time, the C word was a word that should be hushed and not spoken above, a whisper in academic surroundings. The C word is consciousness. And two very well-known scientists, Sir Francis Crick and an associate of his called Michizen, began to do some research on the functions of dream sleep. Crick and Michizen began to wonder about what dreams meant. And what they had found, as had been well known by others before them, is that when you're dreaming, your eyes move back and forth. It's called rapid eye movement. And your eyes seem to be scanning around as if you were actually looking at scenery. In other words, as far as your eyes are concerned, or as far as the mechanism which is controlling your eyes is concerned, you're not having a dream. You're looking at the surrounding territory as you would in normal waking life. And what they tried to figure out is why we dream. And they came to a very remarkable conclusion. They said that we dream, specifically have these REM dreams, in order to remove certain undesirable modes of interaction in the network of cells in the cortex. This they call reverse learning. In other words, what we do when we dream is we dream to forget. And that seems like a rather strange claim to make. We dream in order to forget. In fact, when people quoted them on that, they said that that slogan should not be a mnemonic for their reverse learning hypothesis. They were looking at for dreams as a learning mechanism. And I kind of think I like that idea, that dreams are ways in which we learn. A number of researchers have found that. Jonathan Winson had been doing some experiments in New York City on dreams, but not dreams of human beings, dreams of rats. And he came to the conclusion that rats dream in order to reconstruct pathways to places where food might be hidden, pathways that they had investigated in waking life just before they went to sleep, where they actually had discovered these foods hidden and then went to sleep so that when they woke up the next morning, they would know how to find the food again. So this is intriguing to me, that dreams have a way of teaching us things. Well, this is very interesting, but researchers began to wonder, is it really true? And could they find a way to mechanically reproduce that? Three scientists, Hopfield, Feinstein, and Palmer, actually began to look at unlearning as a stabilizing effect in collective memories. They did this by making a computer model of an interconnection of neurons. They were using a computer analog of neuronal connections. And so they modeled this with a computer program, which exhibited, at least mathematically anyway, what would happen in what we call associative memory. And they were working with things called cells, and they were working with these cells being hooked up in some kind of computer program. Well, the model consists of units which can take on values of, say, 0 or 1 or minus 1 through 1, and an imagination of, or an imagined matrix of, like, wires connecting these cells. And the cells communicate to each other. So if one cell changes, it sends a pulse down the line to another cell. And if that pulse is received, then the cell receiving it would change or not, depending upon the kind of signal it got from the previous cell. And so they imagined that these cells were all linked by, imagine wires, and they imagined that the wire could be thick or thin. They call that the strength of the connection between the different cells. And they said, let's imagine that we can modify the strength between these cells by processes that we input into the computer program so that we can actually change these strengths. And they call these changing strengths weights. In other words, if something was heavily weighted, it had a strong signal between the two cells. If it was lightly weighted, it had a weak signal between the two cells. So they had various weights that they could input. Now, what they did is they began to input various kinds of, let's say, patterns. And with a pattern, they would input a certain pattern, and they would input a certain program of strengths and weaknesses. So some cells were very strongly connected, and some were very weakly connected. And then they would leave it alone. And then they would input not the whole pattern that they just inputted, but a piece of the pattern, and try to see if the computer memory would reconstruct from that little input the whole pattern that was there before. And lo and behold, it did. So then they would try another pattern and input a whole different set of strengths for that pattern. And then another one, and then another one, and then another one. Finally, they would have a whole flock of memories in there. But then, as they began to input different little pieces, the computer memory started to go a bit wacky. What it began to do was one of three things. It would either fantasize, become obsessive, or it would start to hallucinate. Now, this is really getting weird. This is what interested me. Not that they were able to reproduce the patterns that had been inputted, but the fact that they could cause their computer brain to undergo these rather strange behavioral patterns. Let me talk about fantasies first. One of their behavioral patterns was that you feed in a small part of the pattern, expecting the network to reproduce the correct total pattern, and instead, the computer fills in the blanks with entirely different patterns. In the typical joke, the analyst asks his patient what a chocolate cake reminds him of, and the patient answers sex. Then the analyst asks him what a fly swatter reminds him of, and the patient responds, the moon. So what they found out is then when these neural networks were overloaded with too many associations, then what would happen is that the overloaded brain, quote-unquote brain, would begin to associate anything with anything. You give it a pattern which should normally have induced, let's say, a remembrance of, say, the color orange, and it would start remembering chocolate cake or something like that. I'm using equivalences here because what we're talking about is that the patterns that got produced were not the patterns that should have been produced by the inputs that were given to the network. There was another bizarre behavioral pattern that occurred, and this was really funny. No matter what input they fed to their computer network, it always responded with the same output. I would call that obsession. It's like the joke in which the son calls his obsessive mother on the phone and asks, "How are you?" And the mother turns this into her obsession. "You don't love me because you never call your mother." It wouldn't matter what the son had said at the beginning of the conversation, the obsessive mother would turn to the same response regardless. So these researchers, Hopfield and his associates, jokingly referred to this as the 50% of all stimuli remind me of sex problem, meaning that when their nets were overloaded, 50% of all inputs resulted in the same output. No matter what you tell an obsessive person, he or she comes to the same conclusion, usually a negative one. You say, isn't the weather fine? And an obsessive person says, yeah, it's fine, but it's going to rain tomorrow. I can feel the rain coming. And then you say, isn't the weather terrible? Yeah, it's going to rain tomorrow. And then you say, you know, I'm hungry. Yeah, but we walk outside, we're going to get caught in the rain tomorrow. And on it goes. Obsession. Finally, the third one, which is also one that took place, was that sometimes they would hook in a particular input and the net would begin to hallucinate. In fact, sometimes they wouldn't put any input in and it would begin to create patterns. In other words, left to its own device, these computers began to dream. So if computers left to their own devices can begin to dream, maybe that's telling us something about dreaming as a kind of a natural state that matter seems to ascribe to. Now, the Australian Aboriginals believe that there are two forms of time, two parallel streams of activity. One they call the daily activity, in which you and I are very noticeable of and confined to. The other they call an infinite spiritual cycle, which they call dream time, which to them is more real than reality itself. And whatever happens in the dream time establishes the values, the symbols, and the laws of the Aboriginal society. And some people of unusual spiritual power have contact with this dream time. Now, I decided to find out about this. So I spent some time in Australia with Aboriginal people. And one of them was an old fella who probably was around my age now, but at the time seemed old to me. And he said to me, "You have a name. It is your skin name. It's called Jungula." And Jungula, whenever you pronounce Jungula, wherever you are in Australia, wherever you go, you tell people that's your name, Jungula, and they immediately know what to do with you. This is your dreamtime name, but they're going to know who you are. They're going to know where you fit into the hierarchy of their whole culture, no matter what tribe you visit, no matter what language they speak. Skin names are very common among Australian Aboriginal people, and they really refer to where a person fits. Since I had been living with an Aboriginal person and another person, and we had been living together, and I met this old fella, this Australian Aboriginal shaman, since I had just met him, he associated me with these other people and made me their brother. I was their brother. I was the brother of these other people, and therefore my name was Jungula, and that's how I was related. But then he told me something surprising. "Those aren't your brothers. One of them is your father figure, and the other is a son figure to you." I said, "Whoa, he saw them with different skin names than mine." And so this was a really, really surprising thing to me, that just by looking at me, he saw who I was. And I thought, oh, skin, it must have to do with the color of my skin. So I asked him that. He says, "No, it has nothing to do with color." What does it deal with then? And then I found out that for Australian Aboriginal people, skin color is not very important. There's something else about skin that they see that I couldn't see, but that they saw. While I was talking with one of my brothers, whose name was Graham, I was asking him some questions about this dream time. And he says to me, "People of the land are put on earth to carry out the laws of the land and protect the earth. When you die, your spirit goes back into the land again. Before you are born, the spirit comes in and takes the form of you. If a man and a woman who is pregnant see a snake before she knows she is pregnant, the snake will be a sign of the coming birth, and the snake will be a spirit totem of the child. The child also has the spirit totem of the mother, which is its major totem. We are just a spirit that is covered over with flesh and bones." Ponder that for a while. Think about dreams. Think about your own dreams. And see you next time.
This concludes Session 7. Our program continues with Session 8, The Spiritual Universe, with Fred Allen Wolfe.
Well, if some great spirit dreams all of this into existence, including you and me and all those other billions of people we see meandering around this planet of ours, then Maybe we should pay some attention to some of the spiritual questions which arise by considering such a format as that. Is there really a purpose to this universe? And can that purpose be found in our spiritual nature, maybe more so than in our physical nature? In other words, do we live in a spiritual universe? What I want to suggest to you is not only do we live in a spiritual universe, but this whole thing was created for us to have a spiritual experience. And so that's what this next session, session 8, is really all about. Now, I got to tell you right away, I am trained as a scientist. I am trained as a physicist. And because of that training, it is not the easiest thing in the world for a guy like me to begin to talk about spirituality in any comfortable way, because usually spirituality is something that you leave to the guys that have been trained to give spiritual solace, ministers and rabbis and priests and people of that ilk. But that's not me. So whatever I say here, you know, I'm going out on a limb. I admit that I'm speculating here. I'm attempting to build a picture which makes sense to those guys as well as it does to guys like me who are physicists. So I just want to let you know that there's a little bit of discomfort in talking about this stuff for somebody like a physicist. And in fact, many physicists feel that they don't want to talk about it at all, because if they do, that something, you know, bad is going to happen, or they're going to be ridiculed, or maybe even lose their jobs. So I want to say that that is part of the problem. But if we really want to talk about this and try to bring some scientific light into the discussion, then you see, maybe we can offer something more than just belief as a backbone for the kinds of statements that we can make about something like the soul and the spiritual universe. Now, you might ask, why would I want to do that? Well, you know, we live in a world in which things of a spiritual nature are things we have to constantly wring our hands about. We have to deal with it, such as, for example, Planned Parenthood, the right of the fetus. When does a soul enter in the body? Does it really even exist? Or is it just electrical sparks arising in the brain, which gives us the illusion of a soul? Should we worry about the egg cells we produce and the sperm cells we produce? Should we not waste those either? I mean, sometimes you might think it's getting a little bit bizarre, but nevertheless, we're talking about life, aren't we? And so when and how should we concern ourselves with life? Do animals have souls? Should we think about them in a different light than we presently think about them? How should we go about the business of living when living might mean killing? And what happens when we kill? These are the kinds of questions that traditionally are answered in the spiritual background, but maybe we can shed some light on the whole idea of what is soul and whether or not it's present or not, and whether we should really think about all the things we do in light of this new way of thinking. Consider, for example, that some children are born with a lifetime disability, some of them without any sign of consciousness. Would we as a society feel freer to allow these children to die moments after birth if we had a different view of the soul? One maybe more enlightened or less enlightened? I don't know. Without a new enlightened scientific view, the soul may just disappear into the lost pages of propaganda. Even though we, in spiritual practice, think of the soul, we've gotten so scientized in our thinking in the West that it may be an archaic concept to us unless we can find some reason to believe that the soul is an important part of a spiritual universe in which we take part. Well, can't we find a scientific solution to any of these questions? Or should we keep the soul as a mystery and just keep it under the auspices and the heraldry of the spiritual orders of our time? Well, you know, there are spiritual practices that don't believe in a soul or a God or even a self. And yet they're just as spiritual. Maybe they're on the right track. Are they or are they not? Are the Catholics' version of the soul different than the Jewish version of the soul, or the Protestant version of the soul, or the Islamic version of the soul? Or are these just different views of the same thing? Now, should a scientist ask these questions? Well, let me tell you that I'm not the first scientist to start asking these kinds of questions. The list includes people like Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, and he had some scientific interest as well, you know, Isaac Newton. And of course, if we go back even farther in time, we find that the ancient Egyptians were thinking about the soul in perhaps a kind of scientific way. So we're not alone in this, we physicists of today, in thinking about this. And maybe we're not alone in even conceiving of a physics of the soul. In other words, a way in which the soul operates. Now, if you've been paying attention, and I think you have, to the first 7 sessions we've had here, you know that this is all about quantum physics. So you know that lurking behind every word I'm saying is a little quantum physicist saying, tell them about the quantum physics! Tell them about the quantum physics! So let me say a little bit about that. The quantum physics says that there's this realm of existence, this realm of being, out of which everything that we call the material universe, including space and time and matter and energy and all that stuff, arose. And that realm is really necessary for us to understand the physical world. What I'm going to tell you now is that realm and the spiritual realm are not so far apart. In fact, they may be the same thing. So what we're going to be talking about then is, can we use our knowledge of this realm, which arises in quantum physics, this knowledge of this realm in quantum physics, to talk about the mystery of the soul, the mystery of spirit, and maybe even the mystery of God? Well, there are a lot of mysteries to the soul. For example, maybe there is a soul. Maybe it comes into being when I'm born. Or maybe it came into being when the sperm hit the egg. Or maybe it came into being 3 months after that period. Or maybe it came into being at another period of time. Ancient Aboriginal people say that when a pregnant woman walks out into the outback and feels the first sense of life in her belly when the baby kicks or moves an arm or something like that, she believes that the spirit of the land at that point has entered her body and caused that life to appear. And she believes that's when the soul of the land has entered her. Not before, but at that moment. From that point on, she's carrying a soul. Okay? But when does the soul actually appear? Some scientists, like, for example, Francis Crick, believes that our souls are nothing more than our bodies. And Aristotle also thought the same thing. The soul is nothing more than the body. On the other hand, Aristotle's teacher Plato didn't think that at all. He thought there was another realm of existence beyond the realm of the material world, called an ideal reality, and he believed that's where the soul comes from. And in fact, what he thought and what he said was the soul gets confused when it comes into this reality. And what Plato actually said was, the soul is like an eye. When resting upon that on which truth and being shine, the soul perceives and understands and is radiant with intelligence. But when turned toward the twilight of becoming and perishing, then she has opinion only and goes blinking about and is first of one opinion and then of another, and seems to have no intelligence. What is Plato talking about? What is Aristotle talking about? What is Francis Crick talking about? Let's look at what is meant by the term soul for a moment. The word soul arises from the German word Seele. According to feminist author Barbara Walker, the word originally arose as a feminine noun, hence it's die Seele or Seele, and was used by mystics like Meister Eckhart and Goethe in the same sense as Shakti in India, meaning the ultimate feminine reality. Many of the ancient words for soul were also feminine. These include psyche, pneuma, anima, and alma. God's souls were goddesses such as Kore, Sophia, Metis, Sapientia, and Juno. Ancients believed that every human had a feminine soul derived from the mother goddess through the earthly mother. You know, that's an interesting thought because science has shown that we all begin life as females. Did you know that? Did you know that all fetuses begin life as females and that male genitalia develop later during gestation? And if we consider certain aspects of ancient Egyptian and Hebrew mystical sources, such as, for example, the Egyptian Book of the Dead and the Kabbalah, we find that the femininity of the soul has much to do with what is called the feminine principle of structure and creation. Thus, the soul's femininity is connected to the feminine principle of magic and creation. There's another sense of the word soul, and that was brought out by a famous Indian poet whose name is Rabindranath Tagore. He once wrote, "That which oppresses me, is it my soul trying to come out in the open, or the soul of the world knocking at my heart for its entrance?" So here we have two different ideas of soul. One is a personal one, coming into being, a feminine one. And the other is a bigger one, a world soul concept. Now, let me jump to Aristotle for just a moment. To Aristotle, the soul was a principle of animal life. It was a process. It wasn't a thing. In his book, De Anima, which means on the soul, Aristotle attempted to make clear that any assured knowledge about the soul is difficult to obtain. The kinds of questions we have to ask have to be very carefully considered and asked. Asking what is the soul requires us to consider how many different ways there are to answer such a question. Perhaps the soul exists not as a plurality of entities, but as a composite made of different parts of one single entity. Shall we look for the parts and not the whole? Does Aristotle actually prove the existence of the soul through any considerations he might have had? Well, St. Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle both argued that the soul exists and is the prime mover of every living thing without having to move in and of itself. So they kind of implied that it's something invisible. Aristotle's reasoning was based upon his own form of logic, which we now call Aristotelian logic, which is the father of modern logic. Aristotle's point was the following. He said, "Consider an axe. If it had no sharpness and no longer was able to cut wood, would you say it still had the essential quality of being an axe?" "No, of course not," he says. "Sharpness is the axe's essential whatness, and being sharp is essential to an axe's character as an axe. Consider an eye. If it had not sight, would it be an eye?" "No, of course not. It would be a false eye or one drawn on a painting. But that would be an eye in name alone and not the eye's essential whatness." For Aristotle, the soul is the essential whatness which makes the body move. So a body has a soul in the same sense that an axe has sharpness. That was how Aristotle saw it. Okay, let me jump ahead a little bit now, or actually jumping back in time. Plato believed that we all start out in a primal reality, the original one given to us by God. And what concerned Plato was what happens to that vision of that original reality, which he called the ideal reality or the idyllic or whatever you want to call it, when the soul enters into the body. And what happens is that things get distorted and the soul loses sight of what's really important. So everything we do in life, no matter how we try to move and make things happen and whatever we try to create, whatever we do there, it seems like it's always doomed to some kind of failure. We're always like copying the ideal. We're never quite getting there. Think, for example, of a bed. You can think of the ideal bed in your mind. It has the perfect mattress. It has the perfect shape for your body. The covering to keep you warm at night or cool, whatever, is perfect. The pajamas you wear, perfect. The pillow nestles your head perfectly. But now we come to the real beds, and hey, this bed is lumpy, or this bed is hard, or the springs don't work, or it's too soft, it's too this, and I got to kick the blanket off, it's too hot at night, or these pajamas bind me in the crotch, or something like that. The ideal and the real are very separate, aren't they? Yet, we keep striving. We keep striving to produce something better than the last, more ideal than the last. In fact, that may be what the whole principle of the Western way of life is all about, striving to reach the ideal. But think about this for a moment. Where in all heaven's name do we get the idea of an ideal in the first place? We've never seen anything ideal anywhere ever in the whole universe. There's nothing that exists that's ideal. Everything has a little bit of a flaw, a little bit of an error, a little bit of sin, a little bit of evil, a little bit of not so perfect, a little bit of dullness in the sharpness of the blade, so to speak, so to speak, so to speak. But yet we have an ideal in our minds. Well, Aristotle might say, well, that's just your imagination. Maybe Crick would have said the same thing, Sir Francis Crick. But maybe what Plato's telling us is that we have that ideal in our minds because we actually come from that ideal. We are aware of that ideal. It is the ideal that exists in this realm of non-existence, this realm which I call the imaginal realm, the realm out of which the whole universe came into being. So, if we look at what Plato is telling us, and we consider for a moment that we don't live in such an ideal world, we see errors everywhere, what would Plato tell us about this? Is it possible that we're seeing errors because maybe we try to make things ideal, and maybe we create illusions of idealism because we don't ever really achieve it? Plato then tells us a story. He says, I want you to consider the following story. There are a bunch of guys and gals, prisoners. They're chained inside of a cave. And while they're in that cave, they are chained to the walls. And because they're chained to the walls, they can't move about freely. In fact, all they can really do is watch the wall opposite them. And on that wall, all they can see are shadows. Shadows which are cast from the firelight at the entrance of the cave, which shines shadows of people that pass in front of the fire onto the walls of the cave. So they see the whole panorama of all the people that pass in front of the cave. And every once in a while, maybe the fire flickers and they can see shadows of themselves on those cave. All they can see are shadows, shadows, shadows. After a while, they begin to forget that they are prisoners in a cave, and they begin to think only about those shadows as being real. And because of that, because they only see the shadows as being real, they begin to believe in those shadows as being real. Plato has us consider that we are similar to the prisoners in the cave, only watching shadows of reality and making them ideal, even though we may know deep in our hearts that that isn't the case at all. Well, is that really true? I mean, reality looks pretty real to me until we begin to consider, well, what about the TV room in which we watch flat two-dimensional images of characters on a screen flickering about doing ideal movements and laugh when they seem so much like ourselves? And after a while, they seem so much like ourselves that we begin to even behave like those characters we see on the screen. For example, the latest fashion, or the way this movie star wears her hair, I'm going to wear my hair that way. Or remember when Michael Jackson used to do the moonwalk and we would all practice doing the moonwalks? We are very much influenced by the images on the cave wall, which we call the television set. So Plato believes, in spite of all of this and the illusions we are succumbed to, that we are really immortal souls, are having a physical material experience, that we come from this ideal realm. And in embedding ourselves in the ideal realm, things get distorted and we create illusions and have opinions as a result of the distortions that we experience in the material realm. But we all come from that ideal realm. Now, there was another society that also thought about the soul in a way that's maybe similar to what Plato thought. And this was the realm that was believed to exist by the ancient Egyptians. According to the Egyptian Book of the Dead, there was a god of the sun called Atum, and he was completely self-created. In fact, his name means both everything and nothing. Atum can also be compared with the Hebrew letter Aleph, and sometimes related to the Egyptian word Atum, the primal substance. We also use the word Adam, which I think is related to Atum, to mean the primal substance. Anyway, Atum is always presented, is always there, at the beginning and at the end of time. And Atum is a kind of pregnant stillness, like the feeling of the air just before a great rainstorm or hurricane. In a real sense, Atum is nothing, but potentially able to be anything. Well, Atum then made a lot of gods, and all of these gods helped form that which was chaotic and formless into that which was formed. And you know something? That ain't so far-fetched when we compare it with our notion of the Big Bang and how it got created. So all of these different texts, so-called pyramid texts, because they appeared on the walls of the pyramid, all talked about how this god Atum brought into existence everything that we see. Well, what Atum did is he spit a god Shu and he sputtered a god Tefnut from his mouth. In another version, he masturbated them into existence. Here, two of the Greek elements are created. Shu represents air, and Tefnut represented moisture and water. From the marriage of air and water, then came something called Geb, which was earth, and Nut, which was sky. And these two take on their mates and produce couples, Osiris and his consort Isis, and Set and his consort Nephthys. All these gods and goddesses arose from a supreme vacuum. Atum then condensed everything out of that vacuum from these primal elements into the sky and the earth, and that's how everything came into being. The home of the soul is not the physical world, but it is this vacuum world upon which all of this came into being, the world that is able to be potentially anything, the world of Atum. There are a lot of different versions of this story, and there are a lot of stories to be told. Let me tell you a little bit about Osiris and his consort, Isis. Well, here's how the story goes. When you die, your spirit appears at the court of Osiris. And the first thing you do when you appear before the court of Osiris is your soul is taken out. And it's actually the heart of your soul is taken out and it's put on a scale and it's weighed against the feather of truth of the goddess Ma'at. And if your heart is heavy and it tips the scale downward so that the feather of truth goes up. Your heart is then eaten by a great god, and god that eats hearts, and you're spit back out, and that's the end, so to speak, of you. But if you are able to have a light heart, which means that you've assimilated some knowledge in some way, then you get to pass onward into the court of Osiris. Now, when you look at Osiris, Osiris, by the way, is green in color, because Osiris represents something in Egyptian mythology. Namely, he represents the recreation or the coming back into life from the dead. And so when you go into the court of Osiris, and Osiris then says, you are now welcome, what you get a chance to do is come back into life once again. And so the story goes. So the soul's adventure is really a continuing cycle of coming back in and coming back in and coming back in. So in a certain sense, the Egyptians have given us the story of reincarnation. In the land called Chaldea, which is now Iraq, there was a man who was called Abraham, who was actually a Chaldean, who left Chaldea and traveled along into the land of Egypt, passing through what we now call Israel, and founded the tribe of the Jews, according to some legends. These Chaldeans also seem to have some knowledge of what we call Kabbalah. This is speculative, because most scholars attribute Kabbalah to something that occurred in 13th or 14th century Spain. But according to some other scholars, it may have dated back to the time of the Egyptians and to Abraham. At any rate, the view that they had was that there was a great spiritual presence called Aleph. And Aleph was, like in Hebrew, a silent, non-energy energy, non-being being, out of which everything came into existence, like the Egyptian Atum. Today, Aleph symbolizes a sacred mystery. It cannot be ever completely known. And yet, many important words begin with Aleph. For example, Allah, which is in Islam, God. Elohim in Hebrew, gods. Ani, I am. Ish, man. Isha, woman. Ahava, love. Many words beginning with Aleph, symbolizing something about our nature. In Kabbalah, we also find Ani, which is spelled with three Hebrew letters, which in English would look like A-N-I. They're Aleph, Nun, and Yud. If you reverse the last two letters, so it becomes Aleph, Yud, Nun, it's pronounced Ein. So Ani and Ein are spelled with the same letters. And Ein means there is not. Ani means I am. Now, whenever you have in Kabbalah two words having the same letters and having seemingly different meanings, Kabbalists believe there's a deeper secret implied, namely that I am and there is not mean the same thing. So here is a hint that maybe the I am experience is a kind of an illusion coming from that which there is nothing of, there is not. So the I am is really an expression of there is not, or really the same thing. And that kind of idea is the kind of thing, the kind of paradoxical thinking that you begin to do as you attempt to wed together the notions of spirituality, as seen in these ancient wisdom texts, with the notions from modern science. Just as we now find that there is something hidden underneath the physical world, which according to quantum physics is necessary for the physical world, we also find, according to these ancient spiritual texts, like, for example, Kabbalah, that there's a kind of a hidden code implied, even in the Bible as written in Hebrew. And The idea is that the soul acts in a concealed or secret manner on matter wherever it appears. It attempts to influence existence, but not in an overt way, but in a covert way, in an underground kind of a way. It attempts to bring spiritual order into chaotic universe of matter and energy. One of my teachers, Carlos Suarez, told me that what the soul's engaged in is called the war with time. And that the war with time is really the war with space, time, matter, and energy. It's the war we have to face in dealing with ourselves as physical beings. That in so doing, in bringing a physical universe into existence and having this arise, possibilities have to occur which allow for contradictions to arise, which allow for both good and evil to arise. In other words, there's no perfect way in which to create a physical world unless you allow other possibilities to arise. And why do they arise? Why are there contradictions? Why do people believe differently than I do? Why do people think this way and not the way I think? Because there is no one set way of having a physical world. If there were only one set way of having a physical world, this would be a mechanical doll going through its machinations without any creativity at all. Bring in creativity, bring in the idea of a soul entering into matter, and you also bring in the possibility of error and uncertainty and indeterminism. These are all the words that we use, but they come straight out of quantum physics. And they tell us that because we come from a world of possibilities, when we act in the physical world, both good and bad possibilities can arise. So as you begin to think about the nature of spirituality and about the nature of who you are, you've got to remember that in bringing a physical world about, in bringing about your own dreams and your own desires, that possibilities can arise which don't necessarily fit in. And in particular, you may get your wishes granted, but it may be at the expense of somebody else getting just the opposite of what they want granted. In other words, there has to be some kind of compassion, some kind of understanding, something which goes beyond your individual ani self, the individual self that you believe you are. Now, that is why it's important to recognize the soul, the spiritual universe, from a different perspective. That is of the world soul, of there being a bigger self, something which is not just you and your particular concerns, but something which is kind of the global you, the bigger soul, the bigger picture of who and what you are. This, I think, is the true message of spirituality, the true message of the spiritual universe. And what we're saying here is that both ancient and modern visions of this concept called soul are saying the same thing. Your life can transform in dramatic ways once you learn to surrender some of your individuality to this bigger picture. In next sessions, which are coming up, I'm going to tell you a little more about how to do that. So tune in. See you next time.
This concludes Session 8 of Dr. Quantum Presents, A User's Guide to Your Universe with Fred Allen Wolf. Our program continues with Session 9.